KXRN LP.
Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach.
Member supported.
KXFM
on 104.7.
KXFMradio.org.
Couple of minutes after 8 o'clock, and welcome to a Tuesday edition of the Mornings with Ed show. You know, the average person sitting down to dinner probably doesn't even realize how important the role is that bees played in preparing that very meal. And something that might surprise you is that one out of every three mouthfuls of food in the American diet is in some way a product of honeybee pollination, from fruit to nuts to coffee beans. And because what we're seeing right now is that bees are dying at a rapid rate, just last year, 42% of bee colonies collapsed in the United States. Our food supply is at serious risk. Joining us this morning, Melinda Williams and Robin Jones, to talk to us about bees. Good morning, ladies. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
How are you today?
Hi.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming in. So it is, I'm not crazy. The situation is as dire as I just said it was, right?
Yes.
Not exactly.
Okay.
It's a really complicated answer.
Okay.
And I'll try to make it as quick as I can.
No, take your time so that we understand.
Native bees are actually much more threatened than honeybees. And our farming system, because we feed so many people, is a little bit of an issue. We grow what's called monocrops, which means we grow crops of things that have just one thing in it. So we're not planting a variety of things. It's just corn or just cranberries or just blueberries and just avocados, etc. And when you have just almonds, etc., and you're harvesting them or you need to pollinate them, what we do in the United States is we truck in millions of bees and literally put hives on trucks and truck them across the country. And this threatens the native bees terribly. And while native bees have been used, because anytime you introduce a species, and that's basically what we're doing every time we do it, anytime you introduce a species, you're threatening the food source of the local animals, right? So that's terribly threatening native bees, especially bumblebees are on the extinction list, if not near to it. But what we can do to fight that, to prevent that, it's a really simple thing consumers can do is just buy ugly fruit, because one of the things that drives farms to use pesticides is that they need to have perfect fruit for consumers, that we're really too picky.
Right.
And then the second thing is to buy all your fruits and vegetables only in season and only from local farms. Mm-hmm. So Laguna Beach, we're talking about grocery stores that advertise the local farms. You know which ones we're talking about. And then your local farmers market. And actually find out the names of your farmers and where they're located. Mm-hmm. And there's also one in San Juan Capistrano, of course. That's probably the closest, and Tanaka Farms is pretty close also, but San Juan Capistrano is probably the most local to Laguna. But find out your local farmers and find out where your food is from, and only buy from grocery stores that have produce from local farms. And that will help prevent any threat that you are supporting to native bees. Now, outside of the farming thing I just described, the threat that all pollinators are up against that is extremely dire is global warming. So climate change is such a game changer for honeybees, and it is an enormous threat. It's driven the pollen protein amounts down by 50%, so bees now have to forage twice as long, eat twice as much, and process twice as much to get the same amount of protein.
Right.
And, so the risks are a little bit misunderstood, but I hope that makes it a little more clear.
Well, also with climate change, isn't it that unusually warm winters have caused plants to shift their schedules as well? And when bees come out of hibernation, the flowers that they used to feed on, they're not ready.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in fact, it's very complicated, because when farmers do truck those bees, it often saves their life, because especially when they're coming from harsh climates. Mm-hmm. So it's not an easy solve, but small micro farms are the future if we hope to get through climate change.
And that turns me to Melinda. Melinda, that's what you're doing, right?
Yeah, with the help of Robin, I'm a brand new beekeeper right now. Robin, are we like 2.5 months in with my bees?
Yeah, Fantastic.
Yes. They're brilliant. They're just so brilliant. I could sit up there and watch them all day long.
So tell us about how you designed this hive, or what started you, tell us that first step you took.
So it's all because of Robin. She showed up in my driveway. I called her out of the blue, I think, and I said, I'm ready to have bees.
Okay.
I spent a lot of time and money building an orchard. I live in the canyon,
right,
and I have chickens. And I said, boy, I need to get some bees. So I called up Robin, and she's just brilliant. And a couple weeks later, I think it took her, she shows up in a car with 12,000 Italian honeybees from Northern California and a female queen, right, in a little box. This is the most fascinating thing ever. The queen comes in her own little box, right, Robin? And she has her little court with her.
Yep.
And then we open up the box, right, and we have the wooden frames. This part was fascinating. And I was a first timer, so you should see the look on my face. It was like a kid at Christmas.
Right.
And so you take the queen out, and she's got a little cork on the end of her little box. It's a little mesh box.
Okay.
And you pull the cork off with carefully keeping your thumb on it, and you shove like a marshmallow in there.
Okay.
And then you dangle her in the box, leaving her in her box with the marshmallow on the end, stick her down inside the frame, and then subsequently start shaking 12,000 Italian honeybees into the frames.
Right.
So over the course of a few days, they will eat through the marshmallow and get to the queen, but you want them to have time for the pheromones to accept her as the queen, because if she goes in immediately, they will not accept her as a queen and they'll kill her.
Oh.
So it's like delaying the process. Did I say that right, Robin?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Melinda's a biologist, and this makes her an exceptional beekeeper because she likes science.
Yeah. The first couple days, I had a few dead ones, and I was so upset. And Robin came over, and she's like, what are you doing? I had a magnifying glass out because I wanted to study all of the body parts.
So it's an actual marshmallow that they eat through?
Yes, an actual marshmallow.
Okay.
Yeah, they eat through the marshmallow, and then by the time that happens, they will have accepted the queen as their queen.
Okay.
Yeah, but okay. It's just brilliant. There's so much about the biology and the hive, the symmetry of a hive as society.
Right.
Because the hive works as a collective brain, and the collective health of the hive is not the health of each bee. It's the health of the hive. Is that correct, Robin?
Yep.
It's like the health, it's brilliant.
Now, I've heard that you refer to the bees as girls. Are they all female? Are all the bees female?
Robin is like 99% of them are females. Only the drones are a couple hundred drones.
At the height of any season, the most drones you have in a hive is never more than 5%.
Wow. Yeah. And so those are the only boys,
okay,
are the drones. Everybody else, all the workers are all girls.
Okay. And is it workers that are eating through the marshmallow, or just random bees eating through the marshmallow?
It's the nurse bees that are trying to get to the problem most likely.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the ones that tend to the babies and the eggs and feed them to raise the next generation.
And what I found was so brilliant is that everybody, it's very sophisticated. Everybody has a job,
right,
a very specific job. And I guess as they age, their jobs change a little bit, right, Robin? Like when you're
exactly.
first baby, you might just be feeding in the nursery. And then what's really cool, one of my favorite things to go witness that Robin taught me, is if you see the bees outside the door of the hive and they're flying like a figure eight infinity symbol.
Right.
And that's when we first got them. And they're actually like they're like GPSing to know how to find the hive when they leave to go forage to come back.
Okay.
But then some days what happens is you will see a baby bee following flight school instructors. And there'll be older females that will take the babies out and teach them how to fly, and they'll follow them.
That's fascinating.
It's brilliant.
That's very cool.
Yes.
It's like it is flight instruction. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So Robin, you have a background in culinary garden design. How did that influence your beekeeping?
I'm a multi-generation. I have many, many, many generations of family behind me that were farmers.
Right.
And I actually decided to take up beekeeping because I don't even have so much as a recipe from my great grandmother, and I felt like it was a way to connect to her because she was a farmer and a beekeeper, as was my grandfather and great grandfather. So I took it up for that reason, and it's actually not that easy. It's much harder and more complicated than I expected it to be. I thought you just put bees in a box and life would be good.
Right. It's not like keeping bees in a jar, is it?
No, but I kind of thought it was. And it was a little more difficult than that. Bees, in fact, normally So let me back up for a second, because one of the things I said is that bringing a hive into an area where there wasn't one can impact the native bees negatively. Well, there are, according to the Los Angeles Ag Commission, there are 9 wild hives per square mile in Los Angeles, urban Los Angeles. So there are wild hives of honeybees everywhere. And normally what I do is I hive them and requeen them. But in Melinda's case, I got some from my mentor. So I got lucky and got mentored when I was struggling with beekeeping by the world's most published honeybee researcher. His name is Randy Oliver. And so now I teach beekeeping instruction and offer hives and set people up with hives. And Melinda has the most beautiful property ever. It is, she's got an orchard, an amazing garden. We're adding more pollinator plants, more butterfly plants. She's got chickens. She's really got a woodsy, beautiful escapade. And so adding hives there, it makes sense. And we're only doing it in small numbers. And hiving something that's already there is even better. And then we requeen it. But the hive that I gave her is from my mentor. And he's been raising these mite-resistant hives, which is really good to introduce to our wild bees, because they will potentially intermate, and that helps protect them from this parasite that honeybees are up against. Okay. One more thing they're up against.
So what Randy Oliver taught you was really about following the science behind this.
Yeah. So what I say is that I teach science-based beekeeping, and it is part art and part science, but I try to stick to the science. And before I learned that model of beekeeping, I did kill my first few hives, and it's quite easy to do. And so I teach beekeeping instruction, and people have a few lessons with me. Typically, within 6 lessons, they can go on their own. And if they learn to take notes like I teach them, then we can follow through with text and phone. And it's pretty fascinating, and people get hooked and fall in love with bees really quick, like Melinda.
I want to go back to this and think that maybe this is a pedestrian question, but the reason that you're trying to make mite-resistant bees is because pathogens that are carried by mites weaken the bees and make them more susceptible to pesticides, right?
They make them more susceptible to a disease that actually deforms their wings and makes them unable to fly. It's called the formwing virus. The mites are really bad for their immunity, and they threaten the colony's survival. They're one of the top 3 things that takes honeybee colonies out. So when you read that statistic about how many hives we lose them to severe winters with global warming. We lose them to mites, varroa mite. It's a mite that came over from this year's catalog when beehives used to ship through the mail. And it came from Asia, and it's actually extremely beneficial to their bees and not for ours. Right. So Randy Oliver has been working on raising these queens, and they are 100% resilient to mites. So, of course, I wanted to introduce that population to Laguna Beach when I got the chance.
So Melinda, am I naive in thinking that, okay, so I've got some succulents out in front of my house, and there's several bees around them daily, right? Is the hive nearby somewhere? Do they travel far to get...
I think Robin told me that they travel they can travel up to 3 miles. Robin, is that true?
No, it's actually 8, but they would have to have forage along the way, meaning food, flowers. Right. And so it would be more average for them to travel like 6 or 4 to 6.
Oh, one of the things that's the cutest that I go up and watch all my time with my bees is the pollen pants. Robin taught me about pollen pants.
Right.
And you sit there and you can watch them flying in and out of the door, and they show up after foraging, and they have these giant yellow chunky pants on their back legs, and that's all the pollen that they are storing to fly in to the hive with it. It's adorable.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead, Robin.
No, I was going to say that pollen is the protein for the hive. And then the nectar that they take from the flower is the sugar, carbohydrates. And they need both to raise baby bees, so they need both for the colony to survive. And strangely, some flowers don't produce both. Some are better at producing one than the other. So they will go out and seek to medicate the hive with what they need, different.
And back to speaking about all the girls having a different job, the girls that are in charge of foraging, are so busy foraging that they go out from sunrise to sunset. They're foraging all day long, and when they get back to the hive, they don't even take the time to go deep inside the hive to place it in the honeycomb. Mm. They actually exchange the nectar with their sister at the door, mouth to mouth. Is that correct, Robin? I don't want to misspeak.
Yeah, and sometimes in the hive, but they will not be the same bee that puts it into the comb.
Into the comb.
To fan it.
It's just fascinating.
Right. And again, what a shining example of working mothers, by the way. That's just fantastic. Am I naive in thinking that when you raise bees, if you have a hive, I used to think that you would raise them to let them go and let them pollinate the world. Is that naive in thinking, or does that happen? Do you raise
them? No, that's accurate. Yeah. Okay. That's absolutely why. That's why Melinda wanted them on her property, because she's got this orchard and a fantastic garden and all of this wildlife around her. So it's taking a colony and adding a healthy colony and putting it in that environment is great for everything. It's part of an ecosystem.
Okay, but the colony itself will never leave her property is what I'm saying. Will they ever just migrate somewhere else and set up another hive somewhere else?
Explain to him the splitting then.
Well, they're gonna forage sun up to sun down.
Right.
Literally 10 hours most days, all the trips within 4 to 6 miles away. So they definitely leave in that sense every day. And then if the colony decides that they are healthy enough and big enough and don't have enough room, then they will decide to split. And that's when you see a swarm. Mm-hmm. And people are often terrified of swarms. But when they've done that, they've said, hey, they send out a scout bee, first of all, and scout bee goes and looks for a few places, and it's a democratic process. Scout bee returns to the hive and describes a place to the hive, and they do this through dance and the vibration, because bees are doing all of this in the dark, all their communication, complete darkness in the hive, it's black. So they're communicating through vibration, and they vote on when there's a place that sounds like it's good and these digs are real good, let's go. And the queen doesn't have any say in it. She's truly not the girl boss anybody thinks she is. She's kind of has to just lay eggs all day long, up to 1,500.
Yeah, she's got a tough gig.
She lays about 1,000 a day, right?
She's got a tough gig, man. I got to tell you.
Yeah. So when they decide to swarm, they actually push her out the door and carry her in the center, and then that's when you see this giant cluster. She doesn't fly that well once mated. She's quite heavy. She carries all of her eggs for up to her 6 years of life in her. So she's kind of bottom heavy. She's long. She's right. like she's wearing Princess Diana's wedding dress. It's not easy to fly with that kind of material behind.
Right. So, Melinda, what's next for the bees?
Well, I want to get another hive already.
Okay.
It's so much fun. because it is a drought and because it is so dry, Robin's teaching me how to feed them. So I'm making my own sugar, special recipe of sugar water and putting it inside the hive to just assist them so they're not under so much stress.
Right.
Trying to find more pollen and nectar.
Yeah, well, it actually takes 8 pounds of honey to make 1 pound of wax, or 8 pounds of nectar to make 1 pound of wax. And so we're helping the bees build comb quicker by feeding them a substitute of sugar water, which, scientifically has been proven doesn't hurt them in any way. And we would never take their honey and then give them the sugar water. We're always putting the hive first. But this helps them build the wax with it, and then they can go out and deposit the real honey into the wax and use their precious working hours to make food for themselves and babies to fill in the combs instead of working as hard. So that's why we're feeding now.
I love this. Yeah. I absolutely love this.
You'll have to come over.
I will. I got to see this now. I absolutely must see it for myself. So what can the average person who's just rolling through traffic right now, sitting in their car, what can they do to help? Should we put up more? Like, for instance, if I had a hummingbird feeder, can I put up more of those? Would that help?
Up a hummingbird feeder, and you can buy one that's bee-proof for hummingbirds, and then you can buy one that's not bee-proof for bees.
Okay.
And you can, the one for bees, you can feed It should be white sugar, never organic, ironically.
Wow.
Not brown. It should be the white sugar only. Okay. The other stuff is too complex for their digestive system. And then you just mix 50% sugar and 50% water by weight and equal parts. And you heat the water, mix the sugar, and let it cool. Mm-hmm. And you can feed bees that way. You want to place it somewhere where it's not going to bother people. You know, because as we roll into a more severe drought with higher temps, bees are going to get more desperate for food. And that's one of the biggest things they're up against. And one, another reason for that colony collapse number that you gave. What else is it? What people can do is plant organic flowers for pollinators. Bees love purples and blues, and they are constancy feeders, so they will forage the same flowers. So you can plant in repeat numbers, and that's ideal. Go organic. Stop spraying ever any pesticides. Right. You're endangering your entire ecosystem when you do that, and you are putting it out of balance and making your infestations much higher risk. So go organic. Google online, how do I kill my weeds in my driveway without using pesticides? You'll find a million answers. Right.
Old-fashioned pulling them out is a great way. You know, just pull them out.
Use vinegar. You can use boiling water. Mm-hmm. You can use salt in boiling water.
Vinegar.
You can use, there's all kinds of options for pests. You can use a natural soap with water in a spray bottle that's never had a chemical in it before, and use a tiny bit of soap and spray that on your plants for things like aphids, et cetera. So there are so many alternatives to using pesticides that are so much more effective. And the UC Master Gardeners website has really great options. And they also have answers if you want to reach out to them. And they're local.
So say that website again for me, Melinda.
It was UC Master Gardener?
Yeah. UC Master Gardener?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you can just Google UC Master Gardener. Let me see if I have that. I have it. Anyway, other things you can do, buy organic food.
Right.
It seems
to be the simplest things can help the most, really. So first of all, I want to thank Jane Herring for helping produce this segment and lining you both up. This was just, I love this conversation.
So much fun.
And Melinda, is there anything additional you got for us?
I just, Robin, you want to tell them what we're doing this Saturday?
This Saturday we have an event. You can find the event on Instagram. My Instagram is Honey Girl Grows.
I'm not surprised.
Honey Girl Grows, like honey, like grows a garden.
Right.
GROWS. And you can find the post that tells how to sign up. But Saturday, we're doing a honey harvesting class, how to take the honey out of the comb and put it into a jar. I have a hive in an urban area in Venice, and they are honey producing all year round, as most bees in urban spaces are, because those spaces don't go brown because they're on irrigation all year. So urban spaces are actually incredibly great for hives. They're very healthy for hives typically.
Fantastic. Melinda Williams, Robin Jones, thank you so much for being part of the program this morning.
Thank you for your interest.
Yeah, super fun. Thanks so much.
I can't wait to talk to you again. Have a fantastic rest of the day, Robin. Thank you. Melinda, thank you for coming in this morning. It's 8:27. It's the Mornings with Ed Show.